Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A new national security report out today from the Bush administration makes clear that preemption is still very much in the Pentagon's strategic arsenal. And key to that posture, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has made abundantly clear, America's elite military commandos, Navy SEALs, Rangers, Green Berets, and more, the country's special ops forces, quick, highly trained, and lethal. Now, the Pentagon has quietly placed special ops troops in a growing number of U.S. embassies around the world to gather intelligence and, when deemed necessary, to strike. Up next on Point, the uneasy marriage of diplomacy and the new tip of the spear, special ops. We turn first to Washington, where NPR Pentagon correspondent John Hendren has been looking into the growing role of special operations forces. John, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So we've been reading about Donald Rumsfeld's great interest in special ops across a wide front, and now news that there are more special operations forces in more embassies than before. Is this just a shuffling of troops, or is there something fundamentally new here?
I think we're seeing something fundamentally new. Secretary Rumsfeld has put more emphasis and more money into special operations, and President Bush assigned them a new mission, and that was dealing with terrorism. And that's what allows them to go out to these embassies and to, among other things, gather intelligence. This presents kind of a bureaucratic issue because they don't fall under the Director of National Intelligence, John Negroponte. So while they are gathering intelligence and theoretically acting on that intelligence in various countries where terrorists are expected to pose some kind of threat, they don't actually take direction from the head of national intelligence. They take it from the Secretary of Defense. And it appears that Rumsfeld's view on this is that while we're in this long struggle in Iraq, that that's not really what the war on terrorism is going to be about. Mm. He seems to believe that it's going to be a matter of going after these dispersed forces, these dispersed al-Qaeda members throughout 80 or so different countries. And interestingly, that comes up in this national security strategy that we're hearing about today, which talks about the threat of dispersal.
Many and nearly all of these countries, of course, countries with which the United States is not at war. So there's a unique challenge here. Just some basics, John, on special forces. We read that Donald Rumsfeld, under current plans, the Pentagon would increase the number of special ops troops by 14,000 to about 64,000, the largest number since the Vietnam War. What does special ops refer to exactly? What kind of forces?
Well, special ops refers to people from all services, Navy SEALs, Air Force combat controllers, and Army Special Forces. Special Forces usually specifically refers, in the military anyway, to these Green Berets in the Army. And their specialty throughout the years has been to work with indigenous forces. That is, in Afghanistan, they were the guys who teamed up with the local militias and overthrew the Taliban. Of course, with the help of U.S. air power. Mm.
So here we are now, and there's something new going on in the embassies. Now, some things we already know about. We've all seen the Marines at the door in embassies around the world, and we assume that there will be military attachés, American military, to talk to the local military. But the special forces are there with a new writ, a new agenda. What is it?
Well, we're not alone in not knowing about this until recently, because apparently ambassadors in some of these countries didn't know. This came up in Paraguay, where there was an incident that sort of became an international incident when two special forces officers, or soldiers rather, got out of a cab and were robbed. Now, who would want to rob these guys? I don't know, because they're generally pretty fearsome looking. But Anyway, one of the special forces guys ended up shooting one of the robbers. And so, of course, the embassy found out about this, found out that these special forces guys were operating out of a hotel nearby, not out of the embassy.
So pulled a pistol on the street in Paraguay, shot the robber. This robber messed with the wrong guy. It turned out to be U.S. special forces. But there they were on the ground operating.
Absolutely. And suddenly people discovered, hey, there are special forces guys in these countries. And part of what they're doing is apparently gathering intelligence and in some cases acting on it. At least they're authorized to do that, according to the Special Operations Command, which gave me some very sparse details about what their mission is.
It's a Special Operations Command that would oversee all these forces wherever they are. How many embassies do we know there have special operations forces now?
I don't think we really know how many they are. It sounds like there are more than a dozen. They're in the countries you might expect them to be in, South America, Southeast Asia, Africa, places where you would expect, say, in the Middle East region, where you might expect Al-Qaeda to be operating in small cells. And in Latin America, gun running is one of the things that they would theoretically be looking at. Any sort of terrorist activity that spills over there.
So there's issues here around intelligence, who's gathering what, how it's being reported up the chain. Also about, as you say, operations, this new Pentagon catchphrase, find, fix, finish, and follow up. That bespeaks operations. That's reaching out maybe lethally to find and capture or kill terrorists. Can these crews just do that wherever and whenever they like?
Well, they're empowered to do that by the President of the United States now. What becomes complicated is when you don't have coordination with the ambassador or the embassy, and it does seem that now the embassies are required to be notified when these guys are operating in those countries. That doesn't mean they're required to approve of what they do because they report to a different master.
A different master, but more and more in the field. John Hendred, Pentagon correspondent for NPR, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I want to turn now to Washington and David Mack, former ambassador to the United Arab Emirates from 1986 to 1989, assistant secretary of state for Near East Affairs from 90 to 93. He's currently vice president of the Middle East Institute, a Washington think tank. David Mack, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure thing, Tom.
Ambassador, this is a little bit above our pay grade. We're not sure we know what's going on here. And yet when it's U.S. embassies suddenly kind of feeling from the reports locked and loaded with special ops, we want to understand this because this is our country's face to the world. What's your understanding of what's going on here and what's new?
I'm not sure what's new other than a greater quantity of such people, perhaps staying a longer period of time. It's long been the case that there have been special teams of military specialists who have come out to the field on different occasions. And have operated outside of an embassy, under embassy coordination. This has been particularly true, of course, in hostage situations and things of that nature. It appears from these reports that perhaps as many as 20 or so embassies may now have essentially permanent teams of special operators, although the teams may be no more than two or three in some cases. If, in fact, they're there with a fully coordinated operation, with the ambassador, with the head of the CIA station, I can certainly conceive of cases in which they would be doing useful work. To be quite honest, there are a number of states in the world that control their capitals but don't have particularly good control over large parts of their country. There are cases in which it could be very, very helpful if you have very good coordination on the scene with a strong and experienced ambassador who makes certain that that this kind of coordination does take place. And this is far more difficult that there be the same kind of collegiality back in Washington, and that you not have a situation where the Secretary of Defense, for example, simply says, to hell with what the ambassador thinks, to hell with what the CIA station chief thinks, just go ahead and do it. The reality is you may well have a situation where there is a very hostile terrorist group training in some outlying province or in a hostile suburb of a very large urban area, and they may be preparing to take some kind of imminent action against Americans. The first thing you want to do, of course, is try to energize the host government, but there are some countries where the host governments either lack the capability or, in some cases, the motivation to do that.
I've been joined from Washington by David Mack, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Arab Emirates, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, now at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Also joining us right now from Telluride, Colorado, Robert Baer, a 20-year veteran of the CIA. He served as Middle East Station Chief for the CIA. He's author of See No Evil, the true story of a ground soldier in the CIA's war on terrorism. It was the rough foundation of the Academy Award-winning movie Syriana. Bob Baer, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sure you've read these reports, as David Mack and the rest of us have, on this trend in putting more special ops intelligence and operations base into U.S. embassies. As a former CIA Middle East Station Chief, what do you think of it?
I think it's a stupid idea. Embassies are meant for communicating with the host government, or in most cases for collecting information, spying, if you like. And turning these things into military bases will undercut our diplomatic missions. And how effective can a handful of special operations officers be? We do have Marines in our embassies. They do carry weapons, and they do protect the embassies. They work at the behest of the ambassador. It's worked quite fine over the years. And I just don't think you need people with machine guns running around, or you don't need military officers collecting information in a hostile country.
Does a couple of commandos stationed in an embassy turn it into a military base?
That's what the way it's going to look like to the country they're based in. You know, if you take this and do this in Syria, paranoia will run wild about what American bases are doing. Are they out, or American embassies, excuse me, or are they assassinating people? Are they going to kidnap people? It will make diplomacy much more difficult.
What about on the intelligence gathering front? The CIA had both operational and intelligence role at one time, still does, but the Pentagon seems to be moving in more and more here. Do we gain greater awareness by having more irons in the fire, or do we get sort of tangled lines? How do you read it, Bob?
I think this is just a dumb idea. You know, in the past, there's a system that was set up where the ambassador is put in charge of all information collection. If the CIA is in a particular country and it writes a report, the ambassador has the opportunity to weigh in. You have some sort of screening, some sort of control in collecting information. But once you see the military out there, or anybody really, without any sort of central screening process, you get wild reports. Look at the case in Germany about the nuclear weapons of mass destruction vans. They call it the curveball case. That came through DIA. Or you had the Niger documents came through the security office of State Department with no real control. The neocons are calling this competitive intelligence. If you don't like what you're hearing from the CIA, you know, go somewhere else. And that just makes the whole information collection effort of the U.S. government very chaotic, and you're going to get worse results than you have now.
David Mack, how do you read this? I'm seeing here in the Wall Street Journal a senior special operations official quoted saying, asking the question, how do you wage war, a war in which the enemy operates out of a country with whom we are technically at peace? That's the question that the Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, is wrestling with. Are you sympathetic to that difficulty, David Mack?
In very few cases do I think that would be something I'd be sympathetic with. In the vast majority of the cases, the role of special operators is to bring them into the country, take them, introduce them to the appropriate people in the host government, and use them as tools to energize, train, raise the sensitivity level, if you will, and motivation level of those people. With the understanding that there will be extreme cases if they don't do their job, where you might have to resort to some kind of unilateral action. But that would be the last thing you would want to do. The first thing you want to do is, in careful coordination with host government, there certainly have been cases over the years where our special operations people have worked for periods of time in the government, have worked with their own special operations forces as part of making them feel that they are engaged with us, and also as part of raising their level of competence. That's appropriate, and that's appropriate in a large number of countries.
Bob Barham, I'm looking here. Michael Vickers is quoted by the Wall Street Journal, served as an advisor on the Secretary of Defense recently released review of Pentagon spending and strategy. He says the basic model here is similar to El Salvador, except applied on a bigger global scale. That is, comparing this to the Reagan administration's strategy for fighting Soviets and proxies in the 80s, when the U.S., without directly intervening, would provide financial support advisors to indigenous forces in El Salvador or Afghanistan. Do you see that as the model? Is this a familiar model, Bob Baer?
Well, the model here was that the war in Afghanistan, and it was enormously successful.
This is driving out the Soviets.
And driving out the Soviets in the 80s was successful, and it was thanks to Pakistan. The CIA was never on the ground in Afghanistan, nor were special forces fighting the Soviet military. We were using proxies, and the major proxy was, of course, the Afghan Mujahideen and Pakistan. But the key point here is that we had the cooperation of the host government, as Ambassador Mack has said, and without that cooperation, there's not much we can do.
Well, what's to say this isn't the same thing? Ambassador Mack is basically saying, yes, have them there to energize local security efforts.
Oh, I think that's great. But, just have them and have our special forces in a support role. But that doesn't need to be done in an embassy. That can be done through the military attaché. American forces can go to foreign bases, help people out, but this is a traditional program, and it's nothing new. It's what worries me is that you're putting independent Defense Department people collecting on their own, operating on their own, without the authority of the ambassador or the chief of station.
If that's the way it works, let's turn to our listeners. Kathy's calling from Boston. Hi, Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a former Foreign Service officer. I was based in Nigeria in the 80s.
Okay.
And personally, I think this is a terrible idea for two reasons. First of all, my job as an information officer, assistant information officer, was to persuade journalists, professors, the intelligentsia of the goodwill of U.S. policies and intentions and to explain our policy.
Mm-hmm.
There was always a certain amount of suspicion by locals that anyone at the embassy worked for the CIA. I can certainly imagine that this would just make things that much more difficult. It's not any kind of way to persuade people to win hearts and minds. And the other difficulty with it is diplomats don't sit in the embassy. Frequently, I went out into the provinces, and I wasn't going with a Marine security guard. I was going with a driver.
Well, presumably, these special ops people would not sit in the embassy either. They'd also be out around the country.
Yeah, but the point is if you start sending, if diplomats have to keep doing their jobs, going out into the provinces, and you've got special ops people who are, I would assume, not in uniform,
mm-hmm.
you're essentially putting a target around the neck of diplomats who are trying to do their jobs.
And you've been there. You know what that would feel like. David Mack, do you have that concern? Are we militarizing our image and more than the image here in a way that makes it difficult to do traditional diplomacy?
Oh, absolutely. I think that both Kathy and Bob raised some very important concerns with what we may fear the current Secretary of Defense and Pentagon envisage for this program. And I share those fears. The first thing that you want to do in the war on terrorism is to basically co-opt the host government, make them a part of your team, establish an alliance that includes them, because they're the ones that will be far the best and far the most effective in doing it. You look at a country like Saudi Arabia, where it did take a couple of years to raise their level of motivation. But if we had started going in unilaterally into Saudi Arabia and tried to deal with what we felt was some emerging terrorist cells that were in Saudi Arabia, we might have even been successful once. And after that, you can have been sure that the Saudi Arabians would not have taken on the job themselves. They have taken on the job, and they're now doing a pretty good job, actually, in dealing with what's been a very serious terrorist threat within that country.
Great, if you can get the locals to step up and step up in a timely fashion. But I guess the question is, in part, what if you can't? What do you do then? Let me take a call from Abdul calling from Silver Spring, Maryland. Hi, Abdul. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. Yes, you definitely hit on the point. We are kind of militarizing our image overseas. And my point is that suppose something should happen, like, for instance, someone is misidentified and mistakenly killed in this process. Mm. I mean, you're going to get the whole country is going to be against you. You know, and that is just one point I wanted to make.
Watch out when you step out with action in mind if it goes wrong. Of course, that's always a danger. Abdul, thanks for your call. Robert Baer, I'm reading here from John Brennan, a 25-year CIA officer. He headed the National Counterterrorism Center before he retired last year. I'm sure you know him. He said that, you know, the CIA's lead role in many areas is being steadily eroded. And it's his view that the current militarization of many of the nation's intelligence functions and responsibilities will be viewed as a major mistake in the very near future. What's that erosion he's talking about? Is the CIA being sidelined?
The CIA is definitely being sidelined. I agree with John Brennan completely. This is not to say that the CIA should have total control over all intelligence. But the purpose of in founding the Central Intelligence Agency was to coordinate intelligence. It was founded after Pearl Harbor, when all these differing strands of information were not brought to the present quickly enough to react to Pearl Harbor. And we wanted to fix this after Pearl Harbor. And what we're doing is we're going completely the opposite direction. We are setting up these competitive centers, which is a waste of money. And will further get us into other conflicts we shouldn't be in, like Iraq.
Why do you think it's happening, though? The Department of Defense clearly felt some frustration.
Well, there's many reasons. One is the CIA has gone through a very bad period over the last 15 years where it's been unable to collect information for various reasons. We don't need to get into that.
But it's pretty important in a period of terrorism. If the CIA can't do it, what are we supposed to do?
Well, the problem is, you know, when you're in trouble like this, the frustration is you just can't grab your gun and start shooting mm-hmm. right away. Mm-hmm. You have to go back and reorganize the place and be patient and fix a system that had worked at one time.
Let's take a call from Anthe, calling from Lynn, Massachusetts. Hi, Anthe, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question is, what falls under the reach of terrorism in these instances? And I'm thinking, for instance, if we have special ops in certain countries where we might not be particularly aligned with the government or certain groups' interests, for instance, like if a multinational goes into Bolivia to privatize water and people protest, will they be considered terrorists or will we have involvement in areas? I mean, I just want to know what falls under the reach of terrorism in this instance.
That's a very good question. Ambassador Mack, how would you reply?
Frankly, I don't think that that's been worked out yet. And I think that Ann raises a question that all of us as citizens, not just people who've been in the government, ought to be concerned about. People who are involved in counterterrorism for their whole life as a profession often have a very narrow perspective of what the role of government should be in a country. That's part of their job. They have to be very focused. But somebody has to be providing, adult supervision, and that has to be people who've got a wider perspective, who understand the range of our interests in a country, and who also can fit the behavior of people that might be identified as being insurgents or terrorists by these military liaison elements and fit that into a larger pattern of the host country. Basically, that's going to be your CIA elements and State Department elements in country. They're the ones that are going to have that wider perspective.
They're going to have the perspective, but will they have the oversight you're talking about? Or have they been, are they being shunted aside here?
Well, this is the worrisome part of it, Tom. And I don't think that's clear. I have a feeling here that there's a little bit of razzmatazz going on mm-hmm. on the part of the Special Operations Command and the Pentagon. They're saying that the ambassador is going to be fully informed now from here on out as to the entry of such elements into country. I can speak from some experience saying that there are quite a few of our ambassadors who have the experience, who have the strength of character to deal well with such a situation. But I also know a number of ambassadors, both non-career ambassadors who might be appointed for skills in political fundraising or running campaigns or local business leadership that will not do well in such a situation. And for that matter, I know any number of career ambassadors who wouldn't have had the strength of character to really knock heads together and make sure that there is proper coordination among the different elements in a country, whether they're military or CIA or State Department.
Robert Baer, I know we have you just for another minute. If an ambassador gets a couple of, I don't know what, undercover Army Rangers or you name it in his embassy or hers, and they're getting orders from the Pentagon, is the ambassador going to be in charge? Was he in charge when it was CIA running operations? Or is it always, puppeteered from Washington?
The ambassador was always in charge when I was in the CIA. I was there for 21 years, and there was no question the ambassador called all the shots. If you annoyed him or made some stupid error, you were out of the country, gone within 24 hours. CIA chafed under that sort of authority, but it worked.
Where are we headed now, Bob Baer? We've got half a minute with you. Where do you think this is headed?
We're headed to more chaotic foreign policy. We're going to get ourselves into another Iraq if we don't have adult supervision, as Ambassador Mack said.
We'll be joined in a moment from the RAND Corporation by William Rosenau, but let me take a call first from Steve in Columbia, South Carolina. Steve, you're on the air.
How y'all doing today?
We're good. What do you think, Steve?
I'm former military. I was in the 82nd Airborne. We did a lot of combined operations with the Special Forces. And I'm looking at this from the standpoint of the military, you know, the soldier on the ground.
Right.
And the intelligence that the soldier on the ground gets when it comes from a military asset is a lot more usable, a lot more quickly. I look at the example in Mogadishu where intelligence had to kind of be filtered from outside of the military to the military, then deciphered to the troops on the ground, and it caused a lot of indecision time. So that's critical time where soldiers can die.
So you're saying for effectiveness, move the defense intelligence and defense operations further forward, get them together. You're for it.
I definitely am. Yes, I am.
And there's the voice of someone who's been in the field working with the challenges. We saw how Somalia ended up. Let me turn to William Rosenau at the RAND Corporation, a political scientist there. He was a senior policy advisor in the State Department's counterterrorism office from 2001 to 2002, served in the office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict during George H.W. Bush's administration. William Rosenau, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
So here we've got two views on the table. You heard Robert Baer saying this is a recipe for confusion and screw-ups. On the other hand, a caller in South Carolina says, I was in the military. I need intelligence that's very fresh and close to what I'm going to be asked to do. How do you look at this special operations role, pushing forward, pushing into embassies?
Well, I think the caller really hit the nail on the head, and something I haven't really seen reported in connection with this issue. This is a long-standing complaint by military people, by soldiers, by warfighters, that the Central Intelligence Agency does not provide the kinds of intelligence that they need to conduct operations effectively. Now, in defense of the CIA, they're not really equipped, not really organized to do that. The Pentagon, I would say, since the time of Somalia, has been pushing for this kind of unilateral capability. Okay, we've seen a big growth in the Defense Intelligence Agency in terms of human intelligence, sending people out in the field to collect intelligence. This is a long-standing complaint that Secretary Rumsfeld is obviously trying to address here. The other thing I wanted to say is that this the idea that somehow intelligence is going to be militarized is a bit of a misstatement. I mean, it already is militarized. something like 85% of intelligence resources go to the Department of Defense. The National Security Agency, which is our code-breaking and eavesdropping service, dwarfs the CIA.
So you're saying the horse is way out of the barn here. It's already happened.
It's already happened to some degree. And I think the other thing I would say about this is I agree with the other members, the other statements that Special Operations Forces, like everyone else, needs adult supervision. There's no question. I'm not sure whether the agency has always had adult supervision. I'm not sure Bob Baer is totally correct. I'm sure there are many cases in which the ambassador was not informed about covert actions taking place in his country. Okay, the CIA has its own channels. The CIA has its own way of doing business. Everyone needs adult supervision, and that includes things like the FBI. I mean, many agencies of the U.S. government have a presence within embassies, and we need that supervision, certainly. But I think we really need to view this, I view this, I think, much more positively. Mm-hmm. People I've dealt with in special forces, which mm-hmm. is the part of the special operations mm-hmm. world I'm most familiar with, are extremely capable. I mean, language skills, okay, not necessarily on the level of, you know, really good foreign service officers, but mm. lots of experience overseas, cultural awareness, extremely independent, extremely smart, extremely tough. I think we need to start viewing these people as a real resource, and not assume that some mm-hmm. newly minted case officer, you know, fresh from the American Midwest and 23 years old, is going to be a superb intelligence collector in the field. I think these special forces guys can really, really be good and bring a lot to the table.
David Mack, this sounds like a lot of horses for any ambassador to ride. FBI and CIA and now Pentagon Intelligence. William Rosenau points out that already the great preponderance of resources go to defense intelligence. Is there a difference in your mind with your experience? Is the CIA more cooperative with the local diplomats? Is the defense more department more cowboy in its way, or does it really matter?
Well, actually, I had very good experiences working with both military and CIA personnel in the missions that I served in. Mm-hmm. But I did have problems with unexpected visitors. And by unexpected, I mean CIA, at least once, a probable CIA asset that turned up in country without the knowledge of my station chief and caused him considerably more embarrassment than it did me when I blew the whistle on it, having found out from one of my State Department officers. And I have had problems with some military officers or military personnel, not officer level, who stumbled around the wrong part of the country when they should have known better, and they were basically outside of the discipline of the senior officers in country. I think the issue that Steve of the 82nd Airborne
yes.
raised is kind of a special case. I'm not sure that is what we're talking about here in terms of the military liaison elements based in embassies. If you have any situation where you have a military command conducting military operations in the country, I don't think there's any doubt that it's helpful to them to have some independent tactical intelligence elements that are working with them.
But isn't that just what we're talking about here? It's not just intelligence gathering, it's readiness to move to a mission,
well,
to move
you know,
to operations,
but,
lethal
but,
operations potentially.
But the kind of skills that that these personnel have, and they are terrific skills, are not skills that lend themselves very well to collecting intelligence that might be useful, you know, 2-3 years down the line if the security situation in country A deteriorates.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about putting people who are essentially military tactical intelligence collectors into embassies in countries where we are at peace, where we have no ongoing military action, where somebody in their wisdom, I suppose, back in Washington has said, you know, there could be a terrorist presence in that country 2 years from now, and we need to send in some special assets to try to understand it and prepare for the possibility of taking military action against it at some point. I think that would be, in most cases, an erroneous way to proceed. You might need some specialists who are in working under the guidance and in full coordination with the CIA station chief as well as the ambassador. But basically, you do need to have the ability to have a coordinated intelligence assessment of these situations. I'm worried a lot also about the contamination of the kind of intelligence that comes back to Washington.
What do you mean by that? Why contamination?
Well,
what?
When you have both CIA personnel and sometimes State Department personnel and then military personnel also talking very often to the same kind of people, pretty soon those host country subjects that are of particular interest to us figure out how to game the channel. There's nothing like having two or more uncoordinated channels from the same country trying to extract information from you to put a potential subject of our concern in a position where he can, I think, manipulate the flow of intelligence back.
And pretty soon a Mr. Chalabi or somebody else out there is working the system back upstream. William Rosenau, let me put it to you. On the issue of operations, is it already, again, on this front, further ahead than David Mack is suggesting, this find, fix, finish, follow-up? I mean, that's talking about tracking, capturing, killing, planning the next operation. Are we already down the path of operations?
All I really know about this is what we've all been reading in the press, and mm-hmm. so I'm really somewhat speculating here. But I think we have to assume that operations are certainly in the background. I mean, these guys are there not just to, you know, gather all kinds of useful information for the sake of gathering information. They're there to help to do, you know, what they call intelligence preparation of the battlefield, okay? And it's, I think the sense is in the Pentagon, and certainly with this defense secretary, is they can't rely on the CIA. Okay, and we've seen this conflict play out over a number of administrations. It's particularly acute now. The Pentagon wants to have its own unilateral intelligence capability. That's it.
But the CIA, because of its long experience, has fallen under a lot of oversight and law that the Pentagon doesn't. So does this mean that now, you know, Congress has no oversight? It's just the president and Donald Rumsfeld and right down to the operation in the field, period?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, certainly the since the mid-1970s and the creation of the oversight committees, yes, the intelligence community has been under oversight, although it's certainly been a good deal less vigilant in some cases. And parts of the intelligence community until recently haven't been under much scrutiny, namely the FBI. And that's another issue that we might want to talk about. We were talking about, you know, these multiple channels. That's certainly true. It's not just the military and the CIA and State Department political officers, but it's the FBI, which has a huge overseas presence. Legal attachés are in, I don't know, it's several dozen countries right now, and they have their own relationships with internal security services, police services, and so on. So it's not just the military we have to worry about in terms of the coordination. But I think the goal of this Defense Department, or this secretary anyway, is to have this unilateral capability so that if our forces have to go in, they'll have the information that they need. The sense is they can't rely on the CIA.
Does this militarize the American face to the world, and what is the cost of that, if it does, in long-term security terms?
Well, you know, I'm not sure how much it militarizes the face of U.S. security. I'm not sure whether these guys, I assume they're not going to be running around the countryside in their uniforms. You know, and in terms of militarizing U.S. foreign policy, I mean, I'm thinking of things like I was out in East Africa, you know, 2 years ago in Kenya and Tanzania and seeing our embassies there. I mean, ever since 1998 and perhaps earlier, we've turned our embassies into fortresses. And that, I think, presents a much starker, dramatic, delivers a much starker and dramatic message to local populations than anything else, which is we're afraid and we're hiding behind these fortresses.
That's a bigger
issue to me than whether or not we have a handful of special operations people in our embassies.
Tom, can I follow up on Bill's point there?
Yes, please. You've just got a minute. Please do, Ambassador.
Right. In this war on terrorism, our ultimate objective has got to be to get other nations on the team with us, sharing our concern about this problem, realizing that it represents a common threat to all of us, because there is no way that we, by ourselves, are going to win the war on terrorism. It has to be collective effort. So the last thing we want to do, unless the threat is so imminent and so clear, and the host government has demonstrated its incompetence or unwillingness to take necessary action, the last thing we're going to want to do is move unilaterally.
Do you think having the forces there raises the chances that that will happen?
No, I don't think having the forces there does it. In fact, having the forces there and using them in a liaison capacity, and they are called military liaison elements, using them in a liaison capacity with local counterterrorism and security forces can sometimes be a key tool.
Well, we've learned a lot, but
to achieve this objective.
We're out of time. It's a powerful tool. We've got to be careful, obviously, how we use it. Ambassador David Mack, thank you very much for being with us in this hour. And William Rosenau at the RAND Corporation, thanks to you as well. Thanks so much for your time.
This is On Point.